The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. On today's episode, we'll be discussing how easily manipulated we are by rhetoric, polls, statistics, misinterpretation, misrepresentation, and outright lies. Joining us will be Sherman K. Stein, mathematician and author of the book Survival Guide for Outsiders, How to Protect Yourself from Politicians, Experts, and Other Insiders. Before we get to that, hello to 100.3 Sound FM in Waterloo, Ontario. They are the proud owners of a brand new skeptical addition to their schedule. Thanks very much to everyone over there. We appreciate your patronage. And now to speaking up. I'm here today with Matthew Linsdell. His degree is in environmental science from the Vanier College in Quebec, which focused on biology and chemistry with a heavy emphasis on zoology. But he went on to get his personal training certification from the American Council on Exercise. Welcome to Speaking Up, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So personal training, that's a title that we hear a lot, but I don't think I know exactly what it means.
Right, so personal trainers are several ways to get your personal training certificate. You can actually go to a university and study, say, kinesiology. You can do another course with one of the certifying bodies in North America. I did with ACE, American Council on Exercise. I think you can just purchase insurance and start training people.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's good. Pretty straightforward.
So what exactly are you qualified to do when you have your certification?
You're kind of qualified not to hurt people. You're qualified to train people, sort of regular, healthy people, for fitness reasons, really. So train them aerobically and anaerobically, take them through stretching programs, really mild stuff. What you're not allowed to do is really talk about nutrition and things like that. You're strictly looking at health through physical activity. So you coach them through movements to make sure they do them safely. You give them guidance to kind of give them structure to their exercise routine.
So your issue is that a lot of personal trainers are offering services and advice that are outside of that scope?
Absolutely, yeah. Specifically, I've never met a personal trainer that wouldn't give you a meal plan. And that's wrong. You know, if you're not a registered dietitian, you really have no business doing that. I think it's unethical, but virtually every trainer I've ever met is happy to go there, as well as to give people ideas on how they can deal with aches and pains or anything else that happens in their life. They might recommend some sort of herbal patch. I had a client the other day telling me actually about some herbal patches they use, or if they've had a good experience with a chiropractor, they would recommend their chiropractor to their client. I guess it's all in good intention, but I find it very upsetting when I see it happening over and over from trainers I work with.
So do people assume that that's what a personal trainer does, that they do offer advice on nutrition? And
I would say yes. I've actually had people say to me that they want a meal plan, like right off the bat. I want some help with my diet. It's like, wow, I really thought people would look at a trainer more as an authoritative figure on training, not on nutrition. I mean, they go hand in hand to some degree, but they are also separate and they can be dealt with somewhat separately.
So this sounds dangerous to me.
Yeah, it can be really dangerous. I mean, if someone is completely unqualified to give you information on what is or is not a healthy diet, it could be disastrous. And I've seen it again and again. Trainers telling clients that they shouldn't eat meat, or that they should eat 80% of their calories from meat, or, you know, crazy things because it's something that they've done and they've tried, and in their experience it's worked. Just scary.
So why exactly do they do it?
I think it comes from the belief of it's worked for them. They've had experience with other clients and it's been successful for them. I don't think there's ever any malintent. I think it comes from a desire to please. Right? Personal trainers want to keep their clients. This is a way of providing extra service, maybe?
I wonder if they see the personal trainer like a friend as opposed to a professional.
Yeah, ultimately. I mean, right at the beginning, no. You know, there's a little bit of a professional thing you don't want to cross there. But ultimately, yeah, you do become friends, especially if you like your clients. It's inevitable that you will kind of become friends. And I mean, there's a difference between swapping recipes with a friend and telling a friend how they should eat day to day, hour to hour.
And I'm assuming that your clients don't know if you're speaking as a personal trainer when you're talking about things like naturopathy or chiropractic, or if you're speaking as, you know, just somebody who is an enthusiast.
I think that because you're a personal trainer, they assume a certain level of knowledge. And, you know, clearly if my trainer recommended it, it's not going to be bad for me. That's probably what's going through the head of the client. I think the people who tend to have personal trainers tend to have a fair bit of money, and they tend to be searching, you know, they're searching for the thing that's going to make them healthy anyway. And so they're kind of more open to the idea of like a naturopath or a chiropractor or someone making them healthier or fixing that niggly thing that they've always had in their shoulder. Or I don't know. It's hard to say.
So how much oversight is there within this industry? Like, would this be something that would actually be against any of the regulations of your governing body?
I know that within the American Council on Exercise, they do say you're not supposed to discuss nutrition in any depth. That's not your area of expertise. Unless you have specific training in that, you don't do that. As far as the woo stuff, there aren't any real guidelines. And I have to say, without speaking against the American Council on Exercise, they are not the most scientific body that I've ever worked with. They put out some publications and some quote-unquote studies that they sponsor, which are far from peer-reviewed and far from clinical and double-blind. And not that they would be doing really clinical double-blind trials, but they'll evaluate a new piece of exercise equipment or a new exercise program or something, and there's holes right through it. It's a bit frightening. And if you have any sort of biology background, you can kind of go, whoa, what are you guys doing? Like, who's coming up with this stuff?
You know, this is actually similar to something that another guest told us. We had Paul Ingraham on from Vancouver to speak about, I think we called the show, the Skeptical Alt Health Practitioner. And he's a massage therapist who has actually now left the industry.
I've emailed with Paul a bit. I heard him on the show and I really appreciated his candor, and I was intrigued. So yeah, I feel a little kinship with him, and I think that's what made me contact him. And he wrote back, and he was a pretty friendly guy. I think I feel similar things that he feels towards his governing body, but I think with massage therapy, it tends to already be one foot in alternative medicine. And well, that's how I feel about it anyway. Mm-hmm. And he kind of had that science viewpoint of it, whereas I assumed before I got into personal training that it would be full of sciencey biology geeks, you know, people who appreciate chemical cycles and things like that. And it wasn't. It's less sciencey than I'd like it to be. There's a much lower standard for the certification process than I was hoping there'd be.
So if somebody wants a personal trainer and they do want someone who's interested in a science-based approach to personal training, how can they find someone who fits into that mold?
I don't think there's anywhere you can go to find someone who's going to be science-based. It seems silly. They should all be science-based. But probably someone who has actually done, say, a full course in kinesiology. Having said that, I work with people who have done, you know, four-year kinesiology degrees, and they are so, so poorly educated in the sciences. Like, oh my God, you're just shockingly bad. And I test them. I try to come up with non-offensive ways of testing them, because I wish they weren't. I truly wish they weren't. Just like most skeptics would love to believe there are aliens flying around. How cool would that be?
Oh, I know.
You know, I want to believe trainers are just little research scientists, but they're so not. The ones I've worked with, I shouldn't really be making these broad brush statements. I'm really just talking about my experience. Mm-hmm. They get most of their information from muscle magazines. Not all of them, but most of the ones I've worked with. And I've worked with quite a few. And these are expensive trainers. These are not sort of like $20 an hour trainers. These are $100 plus an hour trainers. That's a lot of money to not know what the citric acid cycle is. That's a bit of a science joke there.
What kind of questions can people ask?
Right. Okay. Well, if it were me, and I'm a bit of a jerk, I'd just get them to define terms. I'd say, you say metabolism a lot. What does metabolism mean? And if they can't kind of give you a one or two sentence answer, I'd be worried. If they openly use the term cardio repeatedly.
That's a red flag.
To me, that's a huge red flag. The only problem is it's such a common term in health and fitness. Even if they were well-educated, they might still use it just because the layman knows what that word means.
Right.
But it's really a useless word. There are plenty of great alternatives. I mean, aerobic exercise is better than saying cardio. It's more specific. And people who don't make the distinction, I think, are probably hiding something, hiding a lack of knowledge. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Okay, so cardio is dangerous, possibly, okay. Potentially.
Possibly.
Okay.
If they repeatedly use the word metabolism, things like that. Just asking them, why do I feel sore the day after we work out? If they tell you it's because of lactic acid, wrong. That's a big no-no. They should be able to communicate in a way that they can define things for you that you can use in your life. That's what I try to do. They're really skirting around these questions. You got to ask yourself why. Maybe they're just not good communicators, but maybe it's because their knowledge isn't too great. Having said that, being very knowledgeable on biological terms does not make you an effective trainer. And you can be very, very illiterate, biologically speaking, and still be very effective just by virtue of being in the industry for a long time or having good teachers. Or I don't want to say science will make anyone good trainer. It's not true.
And that's a very good point. So would you advise then that if people are going to seek out a personal trainer, just don't listen to anything besides like the training part of it? Don't ask them other questions?
I guess I would say ask them those other questions based on what they tell you. So if they start to tell you about a diet you should follow, ask them questions on that and see what kind of answers. If they start telling you to take fish oil supplements, ask them why. Based on my research, fish oil is great for people who have had heart attacks, but useless for the rest of the population. So I hear trainers tell me constantly how you should take fish oil supplements. It's great for your joints. Now, I haven't researched this, so I hope people don't get angry with what I'm saying here, but just because your joints are filled with a super slippery fluid, synovial fluid, doesn't mean that if you ingest super slippery fish oil, that it's going to increase the mobility of your joint or anything like that. Kind of weird. Maybe there's been a trial that shows some sort of efficacy there, but I'm not aware of it. And I actually do research. So
the big thing is asking questions.
Ask questions and listen to the answers and then do your research. And if you are a skeptical person with some ability to do critical research, you know, don't just Google it and click on the first thing, then do that. And if your trainer's got some weird ideas, but you're getting results, I mean, stick with them. But personally, I would want someone who was the whole package. You know, you pay a lot of money for these people and you should be getting some pretty solid information and someone who's going to help you reach your fitness goals.
Matthew, thanks very much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
You were listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live on our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking on the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest, and submit a question to be asked in the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations who donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LPFM 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, Free Thought Radio,
WPRR, Public Reality Radio, 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. CIDO, 97.7 FM in Creston, British Columbia. UMFM, 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba. CFAD, 92.1 FM in Salmo, British Columbia. CKOA FM, The Coast, 89.7 FM in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. And CKMS 100.3 Sound FM in Waterloo, Ontario.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're here today with Sherman K. Stein. Sherman is Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at the University of California at Davis. He's the author of How the Other Half Thinks, Adventures in Mathematical Reasoning, Strength in Numbers, Discovering the Joy and Power of Mathematics in Everyday Life, and Mathematics, the Man-Made Universe. He's also the author of the book Survival Guide for Outsiders, How to Protect Yourself from Politicians, Experts, and Other Insiders. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Sherman.
Pleasure to be here.
So is this book a departure from your usual writing, or more of an extension?
Well, it is not a math book. It grew out of my experience as a nuclear activist. 30 years ago, I've been working on this book off and on. I noticed that this little town of Davis, California, where I live, is inside a triangle whose corners had three air bases where there were nuclear armed planes. So I knew they were targets in the case of a nuclear war. Not Davis. Oh, no one would care about little old Davis. But the blast might not hit me, but the radiation would. So I said, gee, I'd better see what I can do and not just sit back here and see a possible victim, because I had read the history leading up to World War I, and it could have been avoided, and it was a terrible disaster created by, so to speak, wise people. And World War II could have been avoided, etc., and accomplished very little. So I read a great deal. I learned all you needed to know about all these missiles and their capacities, the radius of destruction of the bombs. I refused to call them weapons because their effect is disproportionate to any possible cause. So I read a book by Kissinger, and he argued that we could have a limited nuclear war in which we sort of ratcheted it up with the cooperation of our opponent. That seemed rather nutty to me. And then I read a book by Herman Kahn, and it had a different approach. He said, well, there may be a nuclear war. We've got to be very realistic. It can happen by mistake. Flock of geese, you know how this can happen. And it's better to have 20 million dead than 50 million dead. So he concentrated on improved defense. Well, this didn't strike me as very smart either, and I began to wonder, why are they experts? And I, who know the essentials as well as they, am just an outsider. And that started me thinking, I began to wonder, what is an expert? How do we recognize an expert? What do they do for us? And that led to this little book with its 31 chapters. It could not be condensed into a little 10-page magazine article. I spent 30 years collecting the examples, and I think the examples, if you just read the examples, well, that would be enough, because then you wouldn't need to read all the exposition which ties it together. But that is the book, and how we can protect ourselves, and how do we recognize experts? Are there degrees of expertise, and so on? I was listening to the program about the personal trainer. How do you recognize if a personal trainer is an expert? Even there's a problem. So the book is about not just about expertise, it's also about the limits of reason, the limits of our ability to forecast what's going to happen as a consequence of our actions. I could have given it a completely different title. title. In fact, at one point, it had the title The Edge of Reason, but that might have been interpreted as a religious tract, and it really isn't.
Well, you do point out two very distinct functions of an expert.
Yes, I do, and they're very important. In any society, or let's call a society a tribe, because we tend to look down on tribes as primitive, but we're pretty primitive too. And we think we're so advanced because of our TV and our cell phones and our planes that can fly through the air and the submarines that can go through the waters. But if you only have to look back at the 20th century and those two world wars and the Holocaust to realize that we're no smarter than we ever were. In the physical realm, like study of atoms, nuclear energy, et cetera, dentistry, great improvement. Those are all physical, but in terms of making choices and seeing ahead into the future, we're not any smarter than we were in the year 1200, or maybe in Egypt. In particular, one thing that we are not good at is forecasting. Alchemy became chemistry. We turned it into a science. Astrology became astronomy, and we made that into a science. But forecasting, prophecy, only recently have we begun to treat it as a subject of scientific study. And there's a journal founded in 1982 called the Journal of Forecasting. And if you browse through it year after year, you'll see that there's constant complaint that we're not getting any better at forecasting, that we just seem to have run into a brick wall. Whether you make it complicated, or whether you use a computer, or just a pencil on the back of an envelope, we're not getting anywhere. And one of my proposals in the book is that we should start wondering, finding out, what is the limit of our ability to see into the human future? And if we find that our ability is limited, that there is an inevitable fog of peace, then we should be humbler, not just we outsiders, but the, quote, our leaders, our experts. Now, you mentioned, I think I've drifted away from the question, which was the two types of experts. There are two types. One is the professional. He can be audited. You know how well he is doing. The shaman is the other type. Every tribe needs the shaman. The shaman gives the illusion that we are in control of our destiny. And the simplest example of a professional is a juggler. You look at him and you see what he's doing. He's juggling three bowling pins and balancing a ball on his nose and riding a unicycle all at once, and you say, that guy is good. He is an expert. He is what I call a professional. In fact, the joy of his performance is showing that how good he is. And it's easily audited. The audit is absolutely essential. Now, you can go into some fields, and it's harder. Maybe that personal trainer who you discussed here just a few minutes ago would be an example of it's harder to say, hey, is this really an expert?
Right.
Can we audit the performance? So there are certain general careers which tend to breed shamans. The most notorious is economics, because even economists are criticizing their whole field as being empty, having no axioms, no assumptions that are validated over a period of time. They didn't forecast this terrible great recession that we're still, shall we say, enjoying. And it's very hard to come up to an economist and say, oh boy, he's definitely a professional the way a juggler is. So the audit is very impressive. By the way, the most severe audit I have ever seen is by Robert McNamara, that Secretary of Defense in Kennedy and Johnson administration. He wrote a book in which he is called In Retrospect, And I made a list of all of his confessions of what he should have done. Here's one of them. I'll just give you one. I misunderstood the nature of the conflict. He's referring to Vietnam. Now think about this. I misunderstood the nature of the conflict. What was he doing as Secretary of Defense when he was the head of Ford Motor Company? One thing he did is get his engineers to take a General Motors car apart completely so that he understood the opponent. But then he gets into the Defense Department, he's the big shot there, and he says he misunderstood the nature of the conflict. There were a lot of people around who did know the nature of the conflict, namely that it was a civil war, that we had objected to having an election which would have united it. So there is the audit, it's generally informal, and it's impolite, usually, to audit someone's performance because, well, that's mean-spirited. So that those all come together, the audit, the types of expertise, the ability to predict, all of these come together as a single unit. And the book goes into these issues.
Now, is the McNamara example an example of expert creep that you talk about in your book?
You could interpret that way. He had demonstrated expertise when he went to Harvard. He was very smart. He could speak well. He was tall. That helps. You might call it expert creep. He evidently did very well at Ford in organizing the place, and making it competitive. And he had the style of expertise. I would say he was never demonstrated to be what I would call professional, a pro expert. So when he was shoveled or nominated by Kennedy to be Secretary of Defense, it may have been a case of expert creep. He was so good at the Ford Motor Company, well, maybe he'd be good at defense, who knows.
And for our listeners, expert creep is when you're an expert in one field, but either you or others translate that expertise into other fields,
yes,
where you don't necessarily have that.
An example would be, this is a good example perhaps, where Albert Einstein, who had established his expertise in physics, commented on political events, for example, saying that we should devote as much energy to peace as to war. Well, he was listened to because he had established his expertise, and so it gets translated over. That's a beautiful, simple example. The first example, at least recorded, is Charlie Chaplin in World War I selling bonds. He was a famous expert as an entertainer. Well, let's have Charlie sell bonds. And this goes on, of course, today in advertising. Expert creep, utilizing someone who managed to get a name through true expertise.
So we have professionals, and we have shamans, and we have sort of expert creep between them. And how would we tell exactly?
You have to be very alert. It is not easy. But the first thing you can ask is, how do I know this guy knows anything more than I do? Ideally, there should be a record. If there's a pundit who comes on every Friday, say, how have his previous predictions turned out? That's one way. What has he accomplished? Why am I listening to this fellow? Is it just that he's wearing a tie and has a nice suit on? Is articulate, does not use too many uhs and ers? I mean, it's not easy, but if you, once you realize that there are the two types, that at least you know what you are obligated to do, is decide whether this guy is just another outsider like yourself.
It seems like that would be a lot of work, really. Is there an easier way? because most people just practically do not have the time, if they even did have the inclination, to do that kind of research.
Well, I don't have that kind of time either, but I carry within myself an attitude of skepticism. Until someone has proved himself anything other than a shaman, I will assume that, which enhances my own standing and lowers his, and I'm not going to be overwhelmed by what this fellow is promising. It could even include the President of the United States. So that's the ultimate shaman, because nobody is really qualified to be President of the United States. There's too many demands on this ridiculous office. So, but at the same time, I become more humble, and I also humble the, quote, experts who are all around us.
Now, audience, we're here today with Sherman K. Stein discussing his book, Survival Guide for Outsiders, How to Protect Yourself from Politicians, Experts, and Other Insiders. If you have a question, email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet Skeptical Radio. So let's talk about numerical statistics. They're often used in a rather misleading way. Can you give us some examples of how experts use numbers to manipulate us?
Numbers have a magical quality, so they're far more powerful than words sometimes. So we can assume that when we see a number, that someone has really thought real hard about that number. Well, let's take an example. The percentage of drugs entering the United States that are intercepted at the border. Now, what would that percent be? How would you compute it? I mean, you don't know all the drugs that are getting through. So immediately, you should be on the alert. In fact, one of the models is be on the alert all the time. Well, the number given is 10%. 10% gets intercepted.
Right.
Well, where did that number come from? It turns out that a member, an official of the drug agency in the United States, was testifying at the congressional hearing, and the congressman said, well, what percentage of the drugs are you intercepting? And the guy had to say something. He couldn't say, I don't know. He said, well, 10%. And that is where it came from. Now, if you asked a drug dealer who does the actual exporting or importing, what percent, I've heard figures that 1% will be intercepted. But in any case, that's where many numbers come from. They're even if they're computed with a computer and all that, one should be very leery. A good example recently is the estimate of the 10-year cost of health care, government health care, in the United States. There were two different figures, $917 billion in 10 years, the other was maybe $883 billion. But if you have read my book, you will pay no attention to any of them, because these are 10-year predictions and, as such, are totally worthless. For example, you don't know to what extent the diseases of choice will be better controlled by preventive medicine. What are the diseases of choice? Well, those that you get from alcoholism, from smoking, or from obesity. Those are three examples. And if you can control those, you could cut the cost down. So we notice that the computations of these numbers are not revealed, and it's important. If they're going to have any effect, they shouldn't be revealed, because if you reveal them, then their basis can be questioned, and that's not a healthy thing. We need these shamans to indicate that we have some control over our lives. So they were playing the role of shamans, and did as well as they could, which isn't very well, really. That's an example of recent numbers that have been in the press here in the United States.
Well, let's talk about polls. You mentioned them quite a bit in the book. Can you give us sort of a polling 101 lesson? Because I don't think many people are actually completely aware of how they're arranged.
When you think of polling, you'll find out that typically 1,500 or 2,000 people are interviewed, usually over the phone now, because almost everybody has a phone. This number is statistically good. You'd like more, but it costs more. But 2,000 is very good. A good poll, at least, should have about 1,500 or 2,000 people. And techniques of getting fair samples has certainly been improved in the last 50 or years. Now, how serious the results are is another question, because I was once pulled by, I think it was Gallup, and I was asked to, and I discussed this in the book, I was asked to estimate how dangerous each city is that they listed. Minneapolis, New York, Los Angeles, I had lived in Los Angeles, and I thought that, well, it could be dangerous, maybe, I don't know. And, Minneapolis, well, I wanted it to have a good reputation, because New York, well, it's safe as long as you don't walk through Central Park in the middle of the night. So some places I said dangerous, et cetera. I became one of the statistics in this. And in general, we outsiders have opinions on just about everything. And as a result, they're pretty superficial and we're very vulnerable. And that's why I think the polls can change very dramatically depending on attempts by people to persuade us we're very vulnerable. So the polls, at least from a scientific point of view, are well designed. But in terms of the subjects, the individuals that are responding, we're fairly fickle. And I wouldn't depend too much on those polls. But they say sometimes, oh, 3% margin of error. That's just based on past experience. It isn't the kind of error that you can easily compute. It could be much more. But sometimes they're pretty good at predicting elections. So one should take them with a grain of salt.
So we're manipulated by numbers, but we're also manipulated by language by these experts.
Oh, yes. And I do go into these in the book, manipulating words. They're in the United States, you have this debate, should the state tax be removed? And if you want it removed, you call it the death tax. And practically, that settles the whole issue. If you're discussing medicine here in this country, if you use the phrase socialized medicine, well, you just about finished the debate. There's nothing more that can be said. It's socialized medicine. I actually experienced socialized medicine in London when I had pneumonia. I'm an expert on pneumonia. I've had it in Davis, New York, and London. And the treatment was the same everywhere. But if you can call it socialized, then you've won the debate. You can play with these words, especially things which are far away, foreign lands, like government-run medicine, or a war, an occupation in Vietnam or Afghanistan, etc. You can play with the words and say, well, you have progress. It's a standard word. We have progress, and no one knows what you mean. You can get away with this for years. So, yes, the words matter, and words can easily be changed to other words.
Well, when we're talking about things like probability, there are certain words that lend themselves to misdirection completely, words like likely and frequently.
Yes. Well, this is related to the business that we are leaving the art of forecasting in its unscientific state. For example, we have all these words which indicate how reliable, how likely that a future event, we might say, oh, it's almost certain, or very likely, or I'm sure, or even Stephen. Even Stephen is the only one that actually is quantitative, because he's saying it's a 50% chance, and or unlikely, etc. And if you do this, no one knows what you're talking about, because people have investigated this. All the topics that I introduced in the book, people have investigated in a scholarly manner. And there's no agreement. That is, when you turn these words into likelihood, as the meteorologists do, your weather report, 40% chance of rain, 30% chance of rain, then you find that there was no agreement whatsoever on what frequently means. And this is even the case companies that who make predictions and sell them, and nobody knows what they mean. There was a fellow at the CIA who insisted make a weather prediction.
Right.
And one fellow replied, well, you're going to turn us into a casino. And he replied, well, that's better that than just being an old poet talking like a poet. So what we have now is meaningless words when we make predictions. But maybe it doesn't matter because nobody ever checks up on whether your prediction is right. I was thinking of the example in the book when there was about a period of 4 years when the United States was discussing whether to develop supersonic transit, transportation, SST. And I went through the records as the predictions were all there and what would happen if we didn't develop SST. Well, SST was going to be inevitable. It was going to mark the end of the jet transport, and just like the jet transport got rid of the propeller-driven airplane. And, oh, it would lose 150,000 jobs and so on and so on. Of course, we know what happened. But first of all, the United States decided not to develop the SST. The predictions of disaster were all wrong. The Concorde was developed in Europe, and it was a financial failure and ends up in museums. So, but no one penalizes the people who made those predictions. And in fact, you have to be very careful to decide whether a prediction really is a prediction, or is it just a rhetorical device designed to win an argument in which you assume no one will check up on you because of bad manners. So, yes, the fact that you don't want to have these predictions uttered with numbers makes a lot of sense because you could be checked up, just like a meteorologist can be checked up. And a good meteorologist, indeed, when you check his prediction that he makes, when he says it's going to be 30% chance of rain, and indeed, 30% of the time, roughly, it's rain. So if our politicians, our pundits, put percents on, like, I'm 80% sure, and you check up on whether indeed 80% of the time those particular predictions come true, well, then you could make them feel very foolish. So I think as outsiders don't want to check up on how incompetent our shamans are.
Right.
We want them to bear the responsibility of running the world even if they ruin it in the process. And we sit by idly while we still have these nuclear bombs, thousands of them. We are at least slowly getting rid of them, but they stand there as a terrible threat. Does that answer your question?
Very much. And we'll be right back with more from Sherman K. Stein right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we talk cryptozoology with two of the hosts of Monster Talk Podcast. Blake Smith and Dr. Karen Saltznow join us to share some of their favorite stories of fictional fauna. And on Speaking Up, mad skeptic Myron Getman explains how this popular pseudoscience undermines real research. It's an hour of cryptozoology next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We are here today with Sherman K. Stein, mathematician and author of the book Survival Guide for Outsiders, How to Protect Yourself from Politicians, Experts, and Other Insiders. And we have a question submitted by email before the show.
What is your opinion on the Freakonomics books? Are they experts or just cherry-picking? And that's from Allie.
I've read several of the chapters and they're very amusing. They are trained economists. And an economist is a person who can comment on anything which involves money. Money and numbers, and play with the numbers. I read one chapter, I remember, on drug dealers, the economics of drug dealing. And it was very entertaining. And they try to reduce everything to the basic principles of economics, such as supply and demand, or cost cost-benefit analysis, which is amusing. I see no harm in it. To say whether they're experts in this, well, they're not trying to do very much. They're trying to explain or describe things. They're trying to reduce everything to numbers. I think numbers are limited when we're making choices. In fact, I think the fundamental choices that people face or governments face cannot be settled by adding up all the pluses and all the minuses. So in the sense that they are trying to reduce everything to those two principles, I think it's a limited analysis, but it is certainly well-written, entertaining. And that's the way I would say that they're an expert. I don't see what exactly they are expert in, except as entertainers. Very skillful. That's my feeling about the book. I enjoyed reading it.
All right, we have another pre-show email.
Anti-science movements often use distrust of experts as a rallying cry. Vaccine opponents rail against doctors and public health officials and urge parents to trust their instincts. Climate change denialists dismiss anyone with any expertise in climate science as being part of the conspiracy. SC is pushing for the inclusion of creationist material in the state science curriculum. Former Texas School Board President Don McElroy actually said, "Somebody's got to stand up to the experts." Are you concerned that your book might encourage that kind of reflexive thinking that already considers the word expert an epithet? And that's from K.O. Myers of grassrootskeptics.org.
Well, I don't think that we should automatically be critical of all, quote, experts. We have to decide each case on its own. In the case of climate, well, I don't particularly get impressed when we hear that 7,000 scientists signed a document, but I do get impressed by what I call the bullseye when I see that glaciers are melting and polar bears are having struggle to find, you know, food and all that. I don't know why anyone would just automatically hate the discount someone called an expert. I just think we have to decide each case on its own on a pragmatic basis, whether it's evolution or any other controversial issue.
Absolutely, but there definitely is the sense within a lot of mainstream media that experts are the enemy in some cases.
Well, I don't feel that at all. I think we have to be, as outsiders, alert in each case and not just abandon our minds and assume that anyone who comments on a subject is unqualified to say anything, that he has a hidden bias or that there's a conspiracy of some sort. I like to just take each case by itself. I'm a very pragmatic person, and some people, in the case of climate change, study it very carefully and build up a case. I want to know where their information came from. I don't want to just take their conclusions. I think we have a responsibility to think these things out and to get our information from many sources and not depend on any one source. This is what it's like to live in a democracy and not under a dictatorship.
Right.
Say that we're going to pay no attention to anyone who is called an expert would be irresponsible.
But I think that's the problem, is it's very difficult for lay people who maybe don't have access to scientific studies themselves, who don't have the time or the inclination to go after this research. It's difficult for them to figure out who an expert is and who an expert maybe may not be. And you actually used the dead fish principle, which I liked.
The dead fish principle is a very useful one. It basically says, in relation to dealing with a bureaucracy, that the closer you get to it, the worse it smells. This is certainly going to be happening with the financial crisis, the recession in America, as we discover more and more what's going on in these big banks. It's going to smell worse and worse. They're letting the bad news out slowly. Now, you might say this is a very crude kind of image, but it's mathematically or logically the same thing as saying, put your best foot forward. Same thing. You put your worst foot back, or call this the principle, the billboard principle. There's one side of the billboard that is where the message is that's trying to manipulate us, and the other side is the bare wood, bare gray wood. So the dead fish principle keeps you on alert. You always assume that somebody is trying to manipulate you, persuade you, maybe to buy something or to vote some way. You have to be very suspicious because the facts are out there, or what sound like facts, because usually somebody is pushing them. They're out to win. They're out to make money or win an election. So it's not like what I experienced in a math seminar where you're trying to get the truth on something and you can easily check up. So it's a madhouse out there. And the dead fish principle keeps you sane.
So you advise, basically, remaining skeptical.
Yes, skepticism is it. Even in the case of parapsychology, where I wish that we could communicate without the aid of sound or wires of any sort, it would be wonderful, and I would do it. That is, parapsychology and telepathy, it would be wonderful to be able just to concentrate on something and communicate with someone 1,000 miles away in this way. But when I've seen the data, and I got involved in a case right on my campus of a professor who parapsychology, who had a very elegant experiment in which a subject would see a number which was presented randomly by a machine, 0 through 9, the 10 digits, and he would concentrate on this, what he sees, and a person in another room sealed off by lead and copper, and no chance of secret communication or unintentional communication, would try to see what number was being sent. Now, randomly, you'd have one chance in 10, so 10% of the time you would get it just by chance. Just guessing at random. Well, the professor Tart came by and he said, I think I see precognition in the data. Now, precognition means that this person was anticipating the number that had not yet come, which is really astonishing. And then I looked at the data presented by the mechanical device that produced the random digits, and saw that the digits were not random. This automatically validated the entire experiment. I talked to Professor Tart, and I said, you know, you've got to do this over. I even had a meeting with a statistician, the chemist, and Professor Tart, and myself, and we made the case that if the chemist said it, test tube is dirty, you do the experiment over. So, Tart did the experiment over sometime later, and there was no sign of any parapsychological skills. Now, I was disappointed. I would like it. You assume maybe that I'm against it. I'm not against it. But as a scientist, you are always skeptical. You want the experiment repeated. If you cannot repeat the experiment, then it's not science. So the scientist, the mathematician, is always skeptical. I'm skeptical about my own work. If I prove something on Thursday, I check it over on Friday, figuring that it's wrong. And so that's an example. I live by skepticism, and it works. It's very helpful. It gives a much truer picture of the world than just lively.
So you're advocating for basically trying to bring in the scientific method as often as you can in your regular life.
Yes. You may not have time to go into this, but you can at least, given the web, you have access to a huge amount of information, which was never available easily before. And yes, on the issues of interest to yourself, you can do this and check whether somebody has actually studied the subject. And in my book, of course, I give several examples of subjects which were scientific analysis and some that are not. The question is, does God exist is not a subject to scientific analysis. People can model that as they please. In fact, I told the story of a mathematician who he was an atheist. And the other guys in the math department were all devout people, and they didn't like that this atheist was among them. They wanted to fix him. So they brought in a Jesuit who argued with the atheist, and he got nowhere. They went argued and argued. So finally, the Jesuit was just frustrated. He said, "Well, how do you know that there's no God?" And the atheist replied, "There are some things you must take on faith." And that ended the debate, and I guess the math department just had to live with this fellow.
Sherman, that's our time. Thank you so much for being here today.
I would like to mention that you can get this book. It's available at Amazon.com, and that I have a website called Shermanstein.com, is one word, Shermanstein, where you can read Chapter 1 and a lot of supplements to the individual chapters as further examples accumulate day by day. But it's been a pleasure to be.
Absolutely. Thanks, Sherman.
You
can find Sherman at shermanstein.com. You can find us at skepticallyspeaking.com. Follow the links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show? If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put Speaking Up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you.